Election Day is now just 6 days off, but 10% of Florida residents will not be allowed to cast their ballot. Good morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9, and make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. And just ahead, a look at Florida's laws that keep someone with a felony conviction from voting, even long after they've completed their sentence and probation. What do you think about that? Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, UNF Professor Mick Hallett on his new book, The Angola Prison Seminary. Plus, a look ahead to Humana Bold Goal and next week's Jacksonville Jewish Film Festival. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, a look at Florida's voter access, or rather, the lack of it. In 2016, more people were disenfranchised from voting here in Florida than in any other state. 10% of all Florida adults are prevented from casting a ballot this election. In fact, according to the Sentencing Project, today, one quarter of all the people in America who have lost their right to vote under disenfranchisement laws live here in Florida. We're sharing their stories this morning on the program as we welcome Devin Coleman. He's an author, motivational speaker, and he is also with the nonprofit New Florida Majority. Devin is also unable to cast a ballot this election. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
We're also joined in studio by Natisha June from the American Civil Liberties Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Folio Weekly editor Claire Goforth, who's reporting on this in this week's publication. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
And to our callers, Florida has the highest percentage of disenfranchised adults of any state. What do you think about that? What are your questions about the state's disenfranchisement laws? Give us a call. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. You can also weigh in on our Facebook page. And in a moment, we'll hear from Folio and the ACLU and all of you callers about the current situation in the state. But first, let's share a personal story. Devin Coleman, you grew up in this area. You're an author and a motivational speaker. You are also a convicted felon, so you cannot vote in this election. Is that right?
True.
So how did you get the felony conviction?
Well, I was in college, going into my senior year. My roommates and I went to a house party, and altercation ensued. And as a result of that, I end up copping to a plea.
You pleaded guilty to battery? What did you plead guilty to?
I pled guilty to burglary with assault.
Okay.
Grand theft and filing a false police report.
And so at that time, you did a little time behind bars and probation, is my understanding.
Definitely both.
Yeah. Okay. And so years have gone by, you've built a career for yourself, and you'd like to vote again.
Right.
Under the state's current laws, you are not able to cast a ballot.
No.
Yeah. And what do you think about that?
Looking at other laws in other states, it makes me wonder why. Doing networking and surrounding myself with positive people, I met a brother from Ohio, and he thought I could be able to vote. We're talking about voting because in Ohio, returning citizens can vote. In Baltimore, a law was just passed where returning citizens can vote. So it's like, why can't in Florida, the Sunshine State, returning citizens are denied the right to vote?
Now, Natisha, according to the ACLU, which you represent, Florida leads the nation in terms of the percentage of voters or potential voters it prevents from casting a ballot. What does the law say here in Florida?
Well, the law is quite simple, and I always start off with the Constitution, the Florida Constitution, because the question that we're most often asked is, you know, who has the power and, you know, how is that power distributed? So I'm looking at the Constitution of the state of Florida as revised in 1968. And it says that Article 6, Section 4, disqualifications. No person convicted of a felony or adjudicated in this or any other state to be mentally incompetent shall be qualified to vote or hold office until restoration of civil rights or removal of disability. And then we go over to Article 4, Section 8A, who has the power, right? Except in cases of treason and in cases where impeachment results in conviction, the governor may be May, by executive order filed with the Secretary of State, suspend collection of fines and forfeitures, grant reprieves not exceeding 60 days, and with the approval of two members of the cabinet, grant full or conditional pardons, restore civil rights, commute punishment, and remit fines and forfeitures for offenses.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Claire Goforth, according to the Sentencing Project, in Florida, 10% of all adults can't cast a ballot. 21% of all African Americans in Florida cannot cast a ballot. Florida is one of only nine states that ban people who have completed their prison sentences or done restitution for a felony conviction from voting. You're exploring the stories of residents like Devin in this week's issue and making the argument that the state's laws are too strict. What would you say to those who disagree with that, who like the fact that if you've been convicted of a felony, you are unable to cast a ballot?
I would ask them to consider when punishment should end. And these are people who have paid their debt to society, who have completed the terms of their sentences in full, and years later, permanently. I mean, these people could be deprived of their fundamental right to vote in this country indefinitely. You know, Devin hits it on the head when he says returning citizens. These people, they're no longer guilty in the eyes of the law. They have done what they needed to do. And do we want them to be voiceless in their government, or do we want them to be fully participating citizens like the rest of us, which they, in many people's minds, should be entitled to?
Now, under Governor Jeb Bush, 76,000 people who were convicted of a felony had their voting rights restored. Under Governor Charlie Crist, there was automatic restoration of rights. More than 155,000 Floridians had their rights restored. Under Governor Rick Scott, a very different story. Over the last 5 years, just 2,000 people have had their voting rights restored. Devin, a very different approach when you look at the tenures of these different governors. And it's my understanding you told Claire you don't know who you would vote for if you were able to vote, but it's moot because you can't cast a ballot. What do you think about the current situation, Rick Scott's approach to restoration rights?
I would ask why. Looking at statistics, you'll see that returning citizens who have their rights restored, they have a lower recidivism rate than those who haven't. Recidivism meaning going back to incarceration within a certain period of time. So giving them buy-in into the community is stopping them from going back to prison. So why would you stop a process like that?
And Natishia, let me ask you about the Voter Restoration Amendment, which could be on the state's ballot in 2018. This is a ballot initiative that would automatically restore rights to nonviolent felons in Florida. This would change the state's laws about this.
Oh, yes, dramatically. When we look at the rules right now as they stand, waiting 5 to 7 years before you can even apply to get your rights restored, this amendment, this change will not only allow, I mean, let's go back to even Governor Crist. We still had a backlog. You know, we still had a lot of people who were not able to get their rights automatically restored because you still had to apply. So in this instance, when we have automatic restoration, one of those things means that our offender review board is actually being held accountable. They're now updating the system the way they should be. They're sending out the certificates the way that they should be. People are not having to go and wait to fill out an application or waiting these number of years before they're able to get their rights restored. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we're talking, what, 1.54 million people. That is a lot of individuals in our state of 8 million people that can't vote.
Enough, do you think, that would make a difference in a close election, Florida being a swing state?
I think so, because I oftentimes when I talk to returning citizens, that is the big deal. You know, they want to be able to vote. They want to be able to use their voice because who knows the system better than they do? And so I definitely think that it'll make a change. And we also encourage returning citizens, because you can't use your voice, make sure that those around you that you know can, push them to go and vote. Educate them on the process, what you've gone through, and tell them that it's important for them to use their voice since you cannot.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this morning, we're talking about the fact that Florida has more voters who are disenfranchised, can't cast a ballot, than virtually any other state. What are your questions about that? What are your thoughts? 549-2937. John on the South Side. Hi, John. Good morning. You're on the air. Go ahead, John.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear you say go.
Okay.
One, I'd like to apologize on my behalf for being a citizen of the state of Florida for over 45 years and your guest having to put up with the fact that for some reason the administrations of Florida's government has never forgiven him for the crime that he committed, that he accepted responsibility for, and had performed all of the necessary legal duties in which he should have been completely forgiven and his rights restored. The topic you're talking about today is really about two things. It's one, about returning the rights of someone who's committed a crime and paid the price through restitution or through some other means, and as by law, legally forgiven, yet we have an administrative system that won't do that. The other side of that is about voting and disenfranchisement for any voter. The problem that I see with that is it is more a fear factor from a political party that prevents people from voting than really trying to keep specific voters off the rolls. They're more concerned that they want to manage and control who can vote in what areas. And I'll take any other comments offline. Thanks.
Thank you for that, John. Devin.
Hey, thank you. Thank you so much for the support. And he made a good point. Restoration of voting rights isn't about like pre-conviction. We talking about post-conviction after the debt is paid. And even when you look at the plea process, what I pled to wasn't what I was initially charged with. I'm trying to get the thing behind me, right? And that happens to so many citizens in Florida. And I'm a father, owned a couple businesses. I'm a working man, but it seems that we only get defined by one mistake. In a society of comebacks like our society is, it's built upon coming back and building something better. That's what we do. So why disenfranchise people that's trying to build better?
You know, here in Northeast Florida, Claire, we recently saw a change in the state attorney's office, in part due to the majority of voters feeling that some of our sentencing protocols in this circuit in particular were too punitive for guys like Devin.
Yes, I mean, immediately after taking office, Angelo Corey went from being the 20th in terms of convictions in the state, last of all the circuits, to, I want to say, she was third that first year. In her entire tenure, she maintained top five in conviction rates. You know, when people are charged with a crime, it doesn't automatically mean that they have committed the crime or they deserve to be found guilty. And if they are, if they plead to it and they pay their debt, do we want to keep holding them accountable for something that's in the past that they've moved on with their lives? I mean, when Devin was speaking to me about how not only can he not vote for who's going to be our president, he can't vote for who's going to represent him in the school board. He couldn't vote on the tax that we had in August. I mean, these are things that affect us in our daily lives, even more so than who's president of the United States. And do we want to keep people who have done their time, paid their debt, from having a say in our government?
Here's a comment on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Many don't realize how easy it is to get a felony charge. A bounced check can do it. And it's bigger than voting. Returning citizens are also barred from getting all kinds of professional licenses and certifications that can make it hard to get a job. Thanks for that comment on our Facebook page. It's 549-2937 to join us. Let's go to John in Ponte Vedra. Hi, John. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hey. Good morning to you. How are you today?
All right. Thank you. Thanks for calling.
I'm part of the percentage that cannot vote due to a felony conviction. I had a really bad traffic accident where I fell asleep at the wheel late at night coming home from work. And I think a lot of people have misconceptions that people that have felonies are bad people. And, you know, I'm here to tell you that, you know, I feel really helpless in this election, that my one vote could make a big difference. You know, Donald Trump scares me to death. You know, my whole family is Republican. I've been a Republican for a long time. But, you know, I've only been in trouble that one time. It was very unfortunate. Even the judge sat there on the bench and said, sometimes bad things happen to really good people. And, you know, I paid my debt. I did my time, and, you know, I've stayed out of trouble, you know, and, It's really unfortunate. I would love to be able to cast a vote. I would love for my vote to matter, or at least feel like I did something to try to help. And I just really wish that they would do something about this to restore voting privileges to people like me that are good people and that really just want to contribute. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Thank you, John. As we mentioned a minute ago, Natishi June, voters will have the opportunity to weigh in on this in 2 years. It will be the Voter Restoration Amendment. That is likely to be on the ballot in 2018 as a ballot amendment to the state constitution.
Yes, and we worked very hard, and Devin can definitely attest to our work for the past 2 years. What we had to do in the beginning was first get the language verify through the Secretary of State's office. From that point, we had to get 68,500 Floridians to actually sign petitions across the state. I'm happy to report that Duval County was actually one of the first counties and cities to be able to qualify for the congressional district. We have reached our 68,500, and now we are in the process of having the Florida Supreme Court to review the language so that we can continue our work. Our goal this time is 1 million, because we have to have 687,500 petitions signed, and they must be correct. You wouldn't believe how many petitions we had signed this time around that we literally had to throw out because of signatures not being placed, date of birth, or voter registration numbers not being placed, addresses not being on the petition. And so we're very thorough in our process. And the ACLU's office here in Jacksonville is one of the hubs that collected petitions from our area.
Kingsley tweets the show, "What district would Devin vote in? I'd give him my ballot so he could have a say for once. He seems like a stand-up guy." Lots of tweets coming into the show. Let's go to Mike on University Boulevard now. Hi, Mike. Good morning. What are your thoughts?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I applaud your efforts, and I wanted to echo something one of the previous callers said regarding the political realities of this. You know, it's good that you've got a ballot, that you're working on a ballot amendment to circumvent the the issues with the legislature. You know, yes, we are a swing state, but we're awful red when it comes to state issues within the state legislature, and of course, the aforementioned governor. Being that we had a ballot amendment a few years back that was supposed to correct some of our voting district problems, it seems like this is yet another thing that could get under the wheel of a lot of political machinations to prevent it from actually taking place. You know, as long as one party's in power and it sees ex-felons as voting for the opposite party, they're going to do everything they can to get around it. Do you guys have kind of a working plan for what to do in that eventuality? Or I don't know if I'm asking my question right, but, you know, take into account the political realities. How are y'all confronting some of those issues? And are you doing some things within the legislature to try to get around that? Are you doing any lobbying efforts or any kind of additional things other than just the ballot amendment to try to get this viewed a little bit more favorably? And I'll take my answer out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Mike, for that question. Our fearless leader in this, really, Desmond Mead with the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, has been one of the individuals who has traveled across the country to really spread this message about what's happening in Florida. And so I'm certain, and every year, the board actually meets 4 times a year. And each time they're meeting, we're there with a scarf over our mouth. And it's to represent that we're not able to speak. We're not able to vote. So, yes, we do go to the legislature. We do go to the cabinet. And we do silently protest. And, yes, we do have a working plan. We have a myriad of organizations across the state working on rights restoration, working on this amendment. And I can tell you that Duval County was one of the first, but we've had a lot of different regions across the state. I've been in places that I never even thought existed, educating people and training individuals to actually collect petitions because they are passionate about it. And so you know, if you haven't heard about the amendment, Valerie, we definitely ask that you educate yourself, find out about it. I can send you to the ACLU's website. I can send you to the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition's website so that you can review the information for yourself and then pass it on. We ask people to pass it on.
And let me ask you quickly as a follow-up, what would you say to those who don't like your organization, the ACLU? I'll give you an example. For example, in Virginia, the governor there, Terry mm-hmm. McAuliffe, in July, he made a sweeping decision to restore voting rights to more than 200,000 citizens who had been convicted of a felony. That state Supreme Court ruled that he violated Virginia's constitution, that rights should only be restored case by case, not en masse. And so what would you say to those who agreed with that decision and don't like the fact that you're trying to make a ballot amendment that would restore rights to hundreds of thousands of people in one fell swoop?
Well, we're the ACLU, so we're used to a bit of controversy. It's nothing new for
us. A little bit.
Yeah. Just a little bit. And, you know, at the end of the day, we always say that people hate us until they need us. And the reality of the situation is that any of us could fall into this cycle. Any of us could commit a felony, just like the gentleman said before, you know, his felony came as happenstance. He wasn't a bad person. And Devin's not a bad person either. He's one of my good friends. And so the reality of the situation is that you may not like it, but you could fall in that position one day. And if you did, would you want something like this to be available to you? And I think that most of us would probably answer yes.
So what is your plan, Devin, to eventually get your voting rights restored? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I got a buddy system. Me and two friends of mine planning on applying at the same time so we could support each other through the process. In the meantime, you know, I just try to be the best I could be. I go talk to people, especially youth and young adults, like, don't follow in those footsteps, right? But for the people like me that have fell in those footsteps, all right, let's work towards correcting that. And we owe, like, I owe it to the generation behind me to make it better for them and guide them along the path.
Well, thanks so much, all three of you, for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Devin Coleman, Natisha June, and Claire Goforth. You can read more about this in this week's Folio Weekly, and much more still ahead later in the hour. A look ahead to the Jacksonville Jewish Film Festival. But up next, author Mick Hallett on a look inside one of America's toughest maximum security prisons, Angola.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
How far have we come toward racial equality since the Civil Rights era? As PBS presents a nationwide exploration of this question in Black America Since MLK and Still I Rise, WJCT will host a televised forum with a panel of experts to discuss our progress with racial equality on the First Coast. Community Thread, the First Coast Since MLK. Coming November 10th to WJCT Public Television.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, some have expressed concern that Trump supporters might turn to violence if their candidate does not win the election. What constitutes dangerous political speech and how it can incite violence. At 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
This election year, NPR has been traveling around the country.
On the outskirts of Binghamton, New York, 20 minutes from the Las Vegas Strip.
Day of early voting in Texas.
Talking to voters from coast to coast.
People are hurting. People are angry.
Media is biased.
He's not my dream date.
On November 8th, NPR will have live round-the-clock coverage. Join us for results, reaction, and analysis on the big night and the morning after.
Here on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, a recent three-year study of America's largest maximum security prison, the Louisiana State Penitentiary, it's nicknamed Angola. This study explores the power of religious faith in America's toughest prison. Now, Angola is the only prison in the country that allows inmates to run their own churches. But it's also a point of no return for most souls condemned to go there. 90% of its inmates never leave the prison alive. It serves a jurisdiction with the world's highest incarceration rate, too. Dr. Michael Hallett, criminology professor at the University of North Florida, is discussing his new book and study, The Inmate Church at Angola Prison. That's coming up Thursday on the UNF campus. Hallett joins us now with a preview. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
And I hadn't heard about this penitentiary or that it was nicknamed Angola, which has its roots in Africa.
That's right.
But this is one of the toughest prisons in the land. Is that right?
Correct. Angola is the largest maximum security prison in the United States and arguably the toughest because it has the longest sentences. Mm-hmm. Louisiana is the jurisdiction in the world with the highest incarceration rate on an apartheid level. Of incarceration for black males. And I've been a student of a guy named Byron Johnson at Baylor University for pretty much my whole career. And I ran into him by chance one time, and he said, "Hey, would you like to come out and help us study Angola?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to." Angola is the nickname of Louisiana State Penitentiary because it was a former slave plantation, and Angola is the region of Africa where it got its slaves, and the name stuck.
Wow. That's pretty sobering. And so you embarked on a three-year study of this prison, which, by the way, is the only prison in the country where inmates are allowed to run their own faith institutions. So
Correct.
You decided to explore how faith affects the inmate population.
Exactly. Because of its unique history as a slave plantation, informal congregations at the prison when it became a plantation prison in the 1800s, still existed for the longest time and have always existed. And then in 1994, the federal government revoked Pell Grant eligibility for convicted felons. Mm-hmm. And the warden at the time, Burl Kane, thought that because Angola is such a serious prison, revocation of Pell Grant eligibility uniquely impacted the prison in a negative way. So he reached out to a local seminary, New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, to ask them if they would offer some collegiate level coursework as a gift to the prison. So NOBTS, upon learning about the situation with the churches at Angola, decided that they could actually do that and ended up starting a seminary on the grounds of this largest maximum security prison, which later resulted in another unique program called the Inmate Minister Program, where the seminary graduates trained ministers into the Angola population that runs churches on the grounds of the prison, and we went there and studied it for 3 years.
And what did you find?
Well, we found that basically the roots of the slave church has a powerfully transformational impact on the prison. So, you know, after we understood what was finally happening at Angola, the largest prison, five of us working on the project, we basically found that if inmates attend church, define themselves as religious, and belong to an active congregation, they improved in cognitive performance, emotional well-being, behavioral functioning, and lower discipline at the prison. It's the largest study of prison religion ever conducted.
Wow. And so when you release these findings, is it your hope that other penitentiaries might try this model?
Well, as you may not know, 13 other states are in the process of adopting prison seminaries, including Florida. There's a new prison seminary program at Hardy Correctional Institution down near Tampa. And so, I mean, the reason I was brought into the project is that faith-based programming is a form of prison privatization. It's a way for the state to cut costs and to serve inmates in ways that don't raise costs to taxpayers. Now, in the context, though, of mass incarceration, what's really happened is that the individual voices of inmates in prison have sort of been washed out of the academic discourse on corrections. And so what we try to do with our book has just been published, The Angola Prison Seminary, published by Routledge, is to try to remedy that lapse.
And how do you think Angola can set examples beyond the faith question. As you write, there's a real connection here at Angola between America's legacy of racial inequality and what's now called the New Jim Crow, which is sort of a catch-all term that looks at these issues of mass incarceration, voter disenfranchisement, which we talked about in the first segment, and other things.
Yeah, there's a direct connection between present-day American punishment and the legacies of slavery, and felony disenfranchisement is Exhibit A for that tradition. I mean, the reality, Melissa, is that American prisons are in crisis. Taxpayers spend $80 billion a year on American prisons and get for their money a 70% recidivism rate. That is to say, within 5 years, over 70% are reincarcerated of state inmates released from American prisons. So the high cost of mass incarceration has decimated spending on rehabilitation programming inside prisons. And so more and more wardens and correctional officials are reaching out to faith-based providers to provide some minimal level of programming, so that today, unfortunately, faith-based programs are among the only comprehensive kinds of programs available to inmates.
And it sounds as though you think not only should those programs be more widely available, but there should be other rehabilitative programs for people so that when they leave prison, if they leave, at Angola most don't, but if they leave, they have at least a chance to build a life.
Correct. I mean, not only do we need sentencing reform, not only do we need comprehensive kinds of responses to things like felony disenfranchisement, we need to stop warehousing inmates. There needs to be something productive done with people when they find themselves in an American prison system, because these citizens, 95.6% of them, are coming out and returning to our communities.
Isn't that a growing consensus, a bipartisan consensus, really, around the country? You hear it from liberal groups like the ACLU, who we just spoke with. You hear it from conservative organizations as well, that criminal justice reform makes sense, and we should be doing it. And there does seem to be more of a consensus around that.
Yes. I think there are a number of issues in Congress pending because of the election and the drama surrounding that. But I really think that we're going to have some serious corrections reform in the near future, no matter who wins the presidential election. And it's just first and foremost, it's a taxpayer issue.
Now, you're going to be talking about your book and your study. And the book, by the way, is called The Angola Prison Seminary. 6 o'clock Thursday night on the UNF campus.
6 o'clock tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night.
Lufreno Gallery in the Student Union.
Mick Hallett, professor of criminology at UNF and author of the new book, The Angola Prison Seminary. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And more to come. We'll be right back.
November 11th of each year is the day that we ensure veterans know that we deeply appreciate the sacrifices they have made in their lives to keep our country free. Help WJCT honor our veterans during the month of November by submitting a name we may add to our on-air thank you announcements. Go to wjct.org/veterans.
Hi, I'm Lydia Bastianich.
WJCT and FSCJ Artist Series present an intimate conversation with Lydia Bastianich, host of PBS's Lydia's Kitchen. The event is Saturday, December 3rd at 8 p.m. at the Times Union Center. Join us for an evening of conversation and storytelling, celebrating our love of Italian food. VIP tickets available. Ticket info at fscjartistseries.org.
So join me. Life is a combination of magic and pasta. Noi che felicia.
On the next Fresh Air, Stephen Colbert. The Late Show with Stephen Colbert will be preempted on CBS election night. So he's doing a live election night special on Showtime, where he promises
someone will be buck naked.
We'll talk about why he ended the Colbert Report and what it's been like to do a late night show without being in persona. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, it's a bold goal for Florida. Improve this region's overall health by 20% by the year 2020. Humana Bold Goal is kicking off this big effort with a clinical town hall in Jacksonville later this month. We've got a preview now as we welcome Humana's Laura Nolan and Jacksonville family medicine practitioner, Dr. John Montgomery. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning, Melissa.
This is a bold goal. Okay, Laura, how are we going to do this? Improve this region's overall health by 20% in the next 4 years.
Well, it's certainly an enormous task. What we've been doing over the past couple of months is we've been meeting with a number of nonprofits, community leaders, and clinicians to find out what the needs are in Jacksonville. And the needs are great. We want to knock down the barriers to health and health care. And so we're hosting this clinical town hall on November 17th at UNF, and we're inviting all of the leaders and nonprofits in the community to get together to start working in a collaborative effort to improve the health.
That will make a big difference right off the bat, getting everyone on the same page, right?
We hope so.
You hope so.
Yes, absolutely.
Dr. Montgomery, when Laura says we need to look at all of the factors inhibiting better health, what do you see them as being here in this area?
Well, we know that people in this community are dealing with a number of healthcare issues, whether it's congestive heart failure, diabetes, obesity, and the list goes on and on. And then even more recently, when you think about just the impact that Hurricane Matthew had on individuals in terms of achieving their goals. So what we at Humana have decided is that we have to bring a really unique integrated approach to really addressing the issue of improving the health and well-being of the people that within this community. And so we're looking at that. We're looking at how do we bring all the resources together within a community to really leverage those resources to have an impact. And as I talked about, just those barriers, where we've made a financial contribution recently to the community of Northeast Florida to really just help impact through our Humana Foundation to really help impact individuals who are dealing with some of the barriers to health. And
and there are so many barriers, whether you look at our built environment, we're not a very walkable community. We have high rates of sudden infant death syndrome, HIV and AIDS, diabetes, heart disease. We are not at the top of the healthy list by any means. Now, Humana is going to use a measure developed by the CDC called Healthy Days to sort of track our progress. Can you tell us what Healthy Days is?
Right. So over several decades ago, the CDC got together with a number of other individuals around the country and decided and tried to determine what's the best measure for understanding population health. And the best measure that they came up with was a measure called Healthy Days. And it asked several questions. They asked individuals, thinking about your physical health, which includes physical illness and injury, how many days during the past 30 days was your physical health not good? And then we go further on to ask individuals now thinking about your mental health, which includes stress, depression, anxiety, and other problems with emotions, and then asking them the same question. How many days during the past 30 days has your health been unhealthy and your mental health? So what we found out using that very solid, reliable CDC metric is that Jacksonville has about 14 unhealthy days. And when the total is 30, we have a goal.
Every other day we are feeling bad. That's not good.
But when
that's
you think
not
about
what we
it,
want.
Yeah, and Melissa, when you think about it, 1 in 3 Americans have a chronic disease, right? And so they're dealing with a lot of issues. And so just from that perspective alone, being able to have a really solid, reliable CDC metric and say, hey, this is what we're going to measure our progress by.
So if we are looking at 14 days out of every month not hitting the target, Laura, how will Humana Bold Goal try to change that number? What's the new target?
Well, we need that improvement to be 20% by 2020. So that will be our tracking metric that we'll use. And we are going to take a multi-generational approach within the community. There are many barriers to healthcare, but also healthcare can be contagious in a positive way. So if we can get the community working together, we've met with American Diabetes Association, the Boys and Girls Club, Feeding Northeast Florida, and We Care. All of these organizations are doing a phenomenal job, but if we can get everyone collaborating together, we could take it to that next level and work towards that 20% improvement.
So with all of that said, your clinical town hall is coming up on November 17th on the UNF campus. Tell us a little bit about this big event.
So it's really an interesting event. I like to call it, it's like you're bringing the thought leaders all together in the city of Jacksonville and bringing all those thought leaders and saying, okay, collectively, let us see what the issues are in Jacksonville and then how we can collectively, I oftentimes say, everyone leave your own issues outside the door and come in and let's really focus on what we can do to make a difference in the city of Jacksonville. So from that that clinical town hall, we will develop key issues and concerns as it relates to what we want to tackle in Jacksonville as a group. And then we'll form these health advisory boards where individuals who commit to be part of a health advisory board to really key in and target and focus on the issues that we want to impact to help move that 2020 metric.
People tend to go to events at the last minute in Jacksonville, but they need to mark their calendars for this because it will be a sellout, it sounds like.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. We have a esteemed panelist. We certainly have a great keynote speaker. Dr. John Armstrong is coming in. The former Florida Surgeon General will be here. So we really do think that this is going to be an opportunity for us to energize and start that dialogue within the community.
It's Humana Bold Goal, a clinical town hall on November 17th at UNF. Thanks so much for being with us. Humana's Laura Nolan and Dr. John Montgomery joining us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
And in a moment, the Jacksonville Jewish Film Festival. That's next.
WJCT and Vistar Credit Union are honoring the memory of Fred Rogers with Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive. The drive runs through November 30th and accepts new and gently used sweaters, jackets, and blankets. Contributions may be dropped at WJCT and all Vistar Credit Union locations and two men in a truck at 8849 Arlington Expressway. For more information, log on to WJCT.org. Contributions will be donated to selected nonprofit facilities within the First Coast area.
Unlock your newest member benefit. Over 1,000 episodes of your favorite PBS shows. American Masters. Antiques Roadshow. Nature. Nova. Masterpiece. Watch the best of PBS anytime, anywhere. Become a member. Sign in and start streaming today.
WJCT.org/passport.
When pianist Yefim Bronfman played this in Vienna, he had just gotten a bad cut on his finger. He insisted on doing the concert even though he was bleeding on the keys. Coming up, we'll hear Bronfman playing the same piece a week later. Bronfman, Bartok, and Bloody Fingers on the next Performance Today from APM. Weeknights at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, the Jacksonville Jewish Film Festival is coming up next week. It's got an interesting mix of films on the slate, including one directed by a Jacksonville native. With more, we welcome Festival Chair Sunny Gettinger and committee member Ellen Cottrell. You may also know her as the owner of Hobnob at Unity Plaza. Ladies, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You know, there are a lot of film festivals that are popping up in Jacksonville in recent years, and this one is really interesting. This is a film festival where all the movies will have Jewish themes. Sunny, what's going to be screened?
We have a really great lineup. There's a little bit of something for everyone. We're opening with Very Semi-Serious, which, as you mentioned, is directed by Leah Walchuk, who's a Wolfson High School graduate. And it actually just won the Emmy for cultural programming. We're going to have a bagel brunch with it, so it'll be a great Sunday morning event on the 13th. We follow that the same day. We open Sunday with a triple feature. So Sunday, we have The Wedding Doll, which features Maren Rosenblatt, who actually won the Israeli version of the Oscar for her portrayal of a woman with developmental disabilities who works in a toilet paper factory and makes wedding dresses out of toilet paper, which sounds, it's just a really beautiful film. it sounds a little
wedding
crazy.
Dresses out of toilet paper. That sounds that yeah,
we've
that
all done
catches
that.
My attention.
We've all been there.
Well, I've done that at wedding showers.
Wedding showers,
yeah,
exactly.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Now, Ellen, there's some really interesting films here too that are more serious. There's one called Partnering with the Enemy. This is actually a documentary about an Israeli woman and a Palestinian woman who work together to bring imported goods into the occupied territories. That's a very timely topic.
Yeah, it's very timely. And I think it's really interesting just to see the relationship between the two women and how they kind of work through it. And just the feedback they get from their, you know, respective communities and things like that. So, you know, we're hoping to have some kind of conversation after it,
yeah,
after the film, to kind of talk about, have a dialogue about that situation. And just in general, women in business and also different cultural
relationships, the role that relationships can play in solving these sort of big societal problems.
Yeah.
So at this film festival, you'll be talking about issues. You'll be spotlighting talent. There's even going to be some food. Is that right? You're screening a film called In Search of Israeli Cuisine. Will there be food on hand at this one?
Yes. This is definitely a movie that when you walk out of, you're hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And Ellen should really talk about the food because it's coming from Hobnob. But it will be food inspired by the event, and we'll have an Israeli wine tasting. I'll let...
Right. So this movie is basically someone who went through Israel, all over Israel, and in search of Israeli cuisine, which what is Israeli cuisine? And a lot of Israeli cuisine is actually all the influences from all the people that have lived there through the years.
Uh-huh.
So after the movie, like Sunny said, you'll be hungry and you'll be wanting some. So our chef, Roger Regulacion, is going to be preparing two of the dishes from the movie and from the cookbook that's sort of related to it. And then we're also going to be having just sort of
Well, what are those dishes going to be? Can you share?
There's going to be some kind of cauliflower special Middle Eastern something.
Okay.
That's as much as I can get. And also there's going to be some kind of, I'm not going to do it justice, but a fish dish. These are all kind of sampling sizes with a very interesting kind of hummus underneath of it.
I was going to say, there better be some hummus.
There will be. There'll also be kind of a salad.
That is good stuff right there.
We'll be having like a buffet also with sort of Israeli salads and hummus and tahina. That
right. Nice. Baklava. So you'll have the whole gamut.
Right.
Yeah. So Middle Eastern food and Israeli food. And so this is such a cool cultural event that really spotlights the Jewish and the Israeli experience, but it's also a film festival that anyone interested in film should come out and be part of.
Absolutely.
This is going to be at the Jewish Community Alliance Center.
Yes, on San Jose.
Coming up on, and this runs 4 days, so people can come.
It actually runs 5 days.
5 days.
5 days. It's 7 films in 5 days. Is that right? Yeah.
Wow. So yeah. People can come and see as much as they like, and go to the JCA's website for more. And I know that there's something else going on at the Jewish Community Alliance. By the way, there's always something really cool going on there. In addition to the film festival, you're also having the Jacksonville Jewish Community Alliance Jewish Book Festival. What's that all about?
Yeah, we're sort of sister events. And so it opened last night with Shannon Tignay, The Lost Book of Moses, and it continues this week with Jonathan Rabb and Ina Pinkney, a great chef out of Chicago, Jennifer Brown, who wrote Modern Girls, and it finishes with Claudia Kalb of Newsweek, who it wrote a book about Andy Warhol that's really interesting. I think both of these events, there's really something for everything. I mean, we're finishing the movie festival with For the Love of Spock. We have on Tuesday night, we have Once in a Lifetime, which is going to be free for all Duval students. So I just want to make sure that people know that
Holocaust
it's about a
related or
yeah, it's about a French class that does a Holocaust project, mm-hmm. an inner city French class. So it's really
great
all over
students.
The map.
Mm-hmm.
So check out the film and book festivals at the JCA this month. Just go to jcajax.org for more information about these incredible cultural offerings. They're right there on San Jose Boulevard, as Sunny said. Sunny Gettinger, chair of the film festival. Ellen Cottrell of Hobnob, by the way, check them out for lunch or dinner and fun. Good to see you both. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you for having us.
Again, that website, jcajax.org. And that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. And next on Diane Rehm, some have expressed concern that Donald Trump supporters could actually turn to violence if their candidate does not win the election. Just ahead, a look at what constitutes dangerous political speech and how it can sometimes incite violence. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.